Good afternoon, K-Squid listeners. This is KSQD 90.7 FM and ksquid.org streaming on the internet. And we're about to start Sustainability Now.
The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
KSQD thanks Sustainable Systems Research Foundation for supporting Sustainability Now. SSRF provides education, research, and advocacy for regional environmental quality and sustainability-related problems and solutions. For information, visit SustainableSystemsFoundation.org, and thank you, SSRF, for supporting community radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
What's this? It's just black sand. The government treats it like an extension of the land. Sells it off to the highest bidder. They come suck it up with their giant vacuum cleaner, 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 and the government sings. Our green agenda is central to our vision.
Hello, K-Squid listeners. It's every other Sunday again, and you're listening to Sustainability Now, a biweekly K-Squid radio show focused on environment, sustainability, and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. And we are your hosts. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz. And in the other studio is... Oh. Still learning how to do the thing here. Say it again, Brooke.
This is Brooke Wright.
Okay. So, California Assemblymember Luz Rivas recently introduced a bill to ban mining of seabed nodules on 2,500 square miles of seafloor off the coast of California. According to the San Francisco Chronicle, critics say that such mining would kill marine life, damage habitats, and pollute surrounding areas, and ultimately could have a negative impact on fishing and tourism, which together contribute more than $20 billion annually to the state's economy. Proponents argue that seabed mining could provide access to many metals used in cell phones and electric cars and would contribute to the coming green economy. What is seabed mining, and what are those mineral nodules that seem to promise a future full of green devices? Our guest today is Emily Jeffers, a Berkeley-based staff lawyer for the Center for Biological Diversity. Jeffers graduated from the University of California Berkeley School of Law and received her bachelor's degree in biology from Yale University. Before joining the center, Emily served as a law clerk to the Honorable Gregory J. Hobbs, Jr. of the Colorado Supreme Court and worked as a wildlife biologist in California and Idaho. She currently works in CBD's ocean programs. Emily Jeffers, welcome to Sustainability Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, let's get right to the point. Why don't you start by telling us about the Center for Biological Diversity and then what you're doing there?
Sure. So the Center for Biological Diversity is a nonprofit organization, and we work to secure a future for all species, big and little, that are hovering on the brink of extinction. And we do this through science, through lawsuits, and creative media, with a focus on protecting the lands, the waters, and the climate that all species need to survive. And I work in the Center's Oceans Program, where we focus, as you might expect, on the ocean environment and all the threats facing our ocean environment.
Okay. And what is your background then, specifically regarding ocean issues and then seabed mineral nodules, just so our listeners know?
Sure. So I've worked at the center for about 10 years and as a staff attorney. And during that time, I've worked on many different issues that the center has focused on. There's a lot of offshore oil and gas exploration off of the Gulf of Mexico, up in Alaska, off the coast of California as well, that we've been fighting because of course, all the risks that it poses to the coastal environment and to the flora, the fauna, and the people, and the communities that are on those coastlines. We also do a fair amount of Endangered Species Act work, trying to get species that merit protections under the Endangered Species Act protected under that law. And recently we had a victory against the Fish and Wildlife Service when they found that the walrus didn't warrant protections under the Endangered Species Act. And we sued them in federal court and won a victory in that case. Mm. But the issue of seabed mining came to my attention about 8 or 9 years ago when a notice in the Federal Register that Lockheed Martin had applied under the Federal Deep Seabed Hard Mineral Resources Act for an exploration license in the Pacific Ocean, a part of the Pacific Ocean called the Clarion-Clipperton Zone. And they had applied for a license to explore for rare earth minerals. And so that got me interested in deep seabed mining. I hadn't, been aware that this was something that companies had contemplated or that governments had allowed. And so we ended up suing the federal government for issuing this license to Lockheed Martin for failure to examine the environmental impacts of what this exploration would entail and how it would affect the marine environment. And so that's sort of how I got interested in deep seabed mining. And that case ended up settling, and the terms were that if Lockheed ever ended up moving towards, at this point, they're doing just sort of studies and looking at deep seabed mining from land. They haven't actually gone out into the ocean, but if they were to ever go and do at sea exploration, they would have to do a very thorough environmental analysis before mm-hmm. they were able to proceed. And so that's, sort of a little bit of my background in deep seabed mining. And I was so pleased to see the introduction of this new legislation in California that would ban the practice in our coastal waters.
Well, as I will reveal later on, I first heard about these things back in the late 70s. And there's a context for that. But Brooke, you want to go ahead?
Yeah. Can I just ask a quick question? Is the term seabed, is that technical and really it means a specific part of the ocean floor, or is it just a general for any ocean floor?
No, I think that there might be a specific in the federal legislation regarding deep seabed mining. There might be a definition. A technical definition, but to my understanding, it's just any mining on the ocean floor.
Got it. Great. So, and then could you just explain a little bit more about seabed nodules themselves? What are they and what are people after there?
So there's like three different kinds of seabed mining, and they're all, very highly speculative and potentially very dangerous activities. But so the three types of mining, and the first one you're referencing is these polymetallic nodules that are on the abyssal plain. And there are these, basically polymetallic nodules that just sit on the bottom of the ocean. So that's one. And the second is cobalt crusts that form on seamounts. And so the idea there is that you would be stripping the cobalt crust from these seamounts. Of course, seamounts are also biodiversity hotspots, and they support very complex ecosystems. And then the third type of deep seabed mining would be extracting polymetallic sulfides from hydrothermal vents, those really amazing vents that I'm sure we've all seen pictures or videos of that support some of the most unique and important ecological communities known to science. And that we're really still trying to understand right now. We don't know too much about. But I believe California's bill would prevent all three types of mining. The polymetallic nodules, that type is sort of the one that's most known, and it seems to the companies that are interested in seabed mining, it seems the easiest because you would just have to scoop these off of the seafloor, basically.
Not to say
that wouldn't have terrible impacts, but to them that's the easiest thing to do.
Okay. And yeah, kind of to that point, do those types have a known sort of role in marine ecosystems like you described the other two do?
I know that they, those areas on the abyssal plain, they support a vast range of suspension feeders and sediment communities. So even though if you might see a picture of them on the seafloor, it looks like little baseballs or soccer balls sitting on the floor, you know, that that image sort of belies the complexity of the sediment communities that are in those waters.
Do you know, do scientists know how these nodules, you know, were formed? Do you know anything about that?
I think that I've read something at some point, but I couldn't tell it back to you with any certainty. But I do think that people have a good understanding, geologists and whatnot.
Okay. Well, you know, I know that, as I said, I first heard about these things back in the 1970s, and that was a decade, of course, in which resource scares were rife. And there was something mm-hmm. called the New International Economic Order mm-hmm. that was developing. And we can come back to that because I think that's sort of that's pretty interesting. But they've long been advertised as a source of metals to replace terrestrial sources. And, you know, they've been advertised as well as required for green technologies such as solar cells and electric vehicles. So, you know, what is their role in these new technologies?
Well, the minerals in deep seabed, the minerals that these companies are after are rare earth materials or mm-hmm. materials such as copper, cobalt, nickel, and manganese. And it seems to these companies that, well, looks like there's a bunch of this on the bottom of the ocean. Let's just go get it. Of course, there haven't been really many studies at all, if any, on the what would be the impacts of this kind of mining. And, I mean, to many scientists, it would basically be mountaintop mining removal, but under the surface of the water so no one can see it
right.
and protest.
Yeah. So it is, I think, the rare earth materials that are probably these days the most attractive, just because, you know, how much of a supply of these minerals could the nodules provide? Do you know anything about that?
I don't have any figures in terms of, you know, how much is needed, how much is down there. I think that, you know, we don't really have a great understanding of what is at the bottom of the ocean. And so, you know, likewise, we don't exactly know how many are down there.
I think I saw something like 15% or maybe 20% of global demand. So it's, you know, significant, but it's not a major mm-hmm. chunk of them. Mm-hmm. So can you say something more then about the environmental issues and mm-hmm. Impacts? And are there chemicals used in the extraction that could pollute or disturb migratory animals? And mm-hmm. are there any risks of spoils? I'm asking you technical questions. I don't know, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. you know, how easily you can respond to them, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, the way I understand it and the way I've seen it explained and heard it explained is, at least for these polymetallic nodules, they have giant ships that go out into the ocean because these are pretty far out off the coast, hundreds of miles from any coastline. And then they have submersible vehicles that basically suck up all the sediment, including the nodules, and then bring it back up to the ship for processing to sieve the nodules out and then just dump all the sediment back into the water. Uh-huh. So the issues are, you know, multiple. There's a huge sediment plume that's going to be created when all this sediment is dropped down to the surface, in addition to just basically raising the whole bottom of the ocean. So all the critters and all the organisms that depend upon the sediments at the bottom of the ocean are going to be sucked up into this sieve system. Then the sediment plume is going to change the light that penetrates into the ocean. It's going to change the photosynthesis and the microplankton, you know, the phytoplankton and the zooplankton that form the base of the food chain will be affected by that loss of light and the disturbance to the sediments. Plus you have big ships that are going to be crisscrossing the ocean to various places. They'll probably be anchored, and you know, vessel collisions will undoubtedly occur with marine mammals who are you know, in the same place at the same time. So you know, that's just a sort of a start, and since we haven't seen this in actuality, it's really hard to know how extreme, you know, I imagine this is going to be an extreme a calamity when it if it does happen, and I hope it doesn't, but that's sort of the starting point, is it's going to affect the base of the food chain and ripple throughout the whole ecosystem.
Well, we need to take a short break, and then we'll come back and talk some more about this. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the Internet.
KSQD thanks Environmental Innovations for supporting sustainability now. B Corp certified woman-owned Environmental Innovations helps businesses, nonprofits, and schools with free resources and cash incentives from the Monterey Bay Area Green Business Program. More information is available at greenbusinessca.org and environmentalin.com. Thank you, Environmental Innovations, for supporting Community Radio, KSQD 90.7 FM.
You're listening to Sustainability Now, and our guest today is Emily Jeffers, a staff lawyer for the Center of Biological Diversity, and we've been talking about seabed mineral nodules, which are found around the world on the seabed floor. They're basically baseball to basketball size objects. They're spherical, and they contain a whole a number of minerals and rare earths. Some of them are scarcer than others. Let's see, where did we get to? Do you have any idea, then, which type of mining, terrestrial or marine, is likely to have greater environmental impacts?
Well, that's a hard question. I would say they both have extreme environmental impacts. Mm-hmm. Of course, on the terrestrial, we can see them. And so I think that when people see the impacts of mining, and they see strip mines, and they see mountaintop removal, there's a backlash. And what I fear, and what many people fear, is that if this happens in the ocean, there, you know, people don't go to the bottom of the ocean, and they don't know what happens at the bottom of the ocean. And so there's a fear that there won't be an outcry if this does happen, because mm-hmm. it won't be able to be seen. But I think that they both destroy ecosystems, entire communities of plants and animals, and many that we haven't even discovered yet, unknown to science.
Yeah. I was doing some reading up on the topic, and I think, again, not very many people have tried to compare the two, especially because seabed mining hasn't really been done except for a couple of pilot projects.
Can I chime in?
Yeah, please, Brooke.
Yeah, I just want to say one thing I came across when I was reading about it is that those projects that do involve research are highly biased. They tend to be, you know, funded by the mining companies themselves. So I was just curious if you know, has there been any research to understand its impacts that really isn't funded in that way?
Yes, I think there are some scientists. I know some down at Scripps. There's a coalition called the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, and there are a number of scientists affiliated with that. And you can go to that homepage to learn about their position on deep sea mining and some of the impacts. But I agree, a lot of the studies that purport to analyze the environmental impacts are they were done by the miners and their employees or their contractors. So it's hard to get a good understanding. Plus, this is such a remote part of the world. It's such a harsh environment. We don't know much about it to begin with, let alone how the baseline would change if this dramatic dramatic effect were to occur.
Well, another thing we read was that. There haven't been very many attempts to do this seabed mining. That Japan conducted experimental seabed mining near Okinawa, that a Canadian firm wants to mine in Nauru's exclusive economic zone. I think, that's that particular area that you were referring to. And that's some 30 contracts have been signed to do seabed mining off various coasts around the world. But again, how far along are these companies? Is there any sign that anybody's actually going to try to do it?
So there are no, in international waters, that is waters that are outside the exclusive economic zone of any nation. Those are subject to the jurisdiction of the International Seabed Authority. And they're in the process of finalizing the regulations that would govern any extraction of minerals from the deep sea. And the United States, because we are not party to the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, we are not a member of the International Seabed Authority. And we have our own statute, which I mentioned before, regarding deep sea mining. But because, you know, we are not a party to the Law of the Sea and not a member of the International Seabed Authority, we don't necessarily, our government at least, doesn't necessarily recognize those contracts. And we have also issued contracts under our own national legislation regarding those same areas. So it's a bit of a mess, but there certainly is a lot of interest in those tracts of sea in the high seas. So I think that once the regulations are finalized by the ISA, I think there looks to be a rush.
And I think scheduled for like 2023. Is that right?
That sounds about right. Yeah, they've issued draft regulations, but they haven't been finalized, I believe.
Can you give us a better sense of how the International Seabed Authority operates?
Well, it's based in Jamaica, and it's made up of over 150 member states. And it's in the Law of the Sea. There's a requirement to create this authority that will organize, regulate, and control all the mineral-based activities in the international seabed area. And in its guiding document, it says it must be done, quote, for the benefit of mankind as a whole. And there's a lot of debate as to what that means. Many people think, well, the benefit of mankind will not be served by tearing up the bottom of the sea with no real understanding of how that's going to impact mankind. And other people argue for, well, we need these minerals. So, you know, that's their charter is to regulate and control mineral activities. And it's certainly within their prerogative to ban the activities. But many of the nations who are party to the Law of the Sea want this to happen.
Well, I mean, they see it as a potential bonanza. Right.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
I recall that the ISA was set up to basically adjudicate between the territorial claims or the claims of Western corporations and third world countries, what we would now call the global South. Is that still part of the procedure?
You know, because the United States is not party to the Law of the Sea and we're not a member of the ISA, I haven't followed too closely the comings and goings of the ISA. I've commented on some of their regulations, but I don't know exactly the ins and outs of how they operate.
Yeah, well, okay. So what I do recall is that when a corporation expresses interest in a particular tract of land, mm-hmm. They're supposed to then, third world countries were then allowed, or this maybe it was the ISA, would identify an adjacent tract. And then there would be mining, and half of the stuff would go to the corporation, and the other half would go into the revenues would go into a fund for third world economic development. That was sort of the original intention.
That does sound familiar, and I believe a lot of companies like Lockheed and other big multinational corporations have, you know, because the companies have to partner with a government to apply for a license under the ISA. And so that's why little countries like Nauru and other, you know, tiny nation states in the Pacific, they're being approached by Lockheed and other big companies to sponsor them, basically, because those tiny countries will get a big cut of whatever Lockheed extracts.
Somehow, I'm skeptical of that, but
that's the idea, at least.
Yeah, I mean, my recollection was that the companies would then, you know, they would mine the entire tract, and then I think give half of the proceeds to this fund to be managed by the ISA. But it's been a long time since I looked at the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea.
Can I ask a question? Do you have a sense of why the U.S. is not party to it?
That is very complicated, and I think lots of different people have lots of different reasons. So I think that some conservatives argue that the United States should not limit themselves to this organization, that we as a powerful country can go out anywhere into the international waters and mine wherever we want. And we shouldn't have to be constrained by, you know, whatever the ISA says we can do. But there are other reasons that are complicated, but that's one that I've heard.
But meanwhile, we haven't done this. There hasn't been any seabed nodule mining itself.
Okay. Well,
I mean, again, I don't want to throw my weight around, but as I recall, the Carter administration played a central role in the negotiations over UNCLOS, which is the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, and was at least played a role in devising the seabed authority. It's hard to remember. And then the Reagan administration came in and basically saw this as a grab of potential private property.
Mm-hmm.
And so it may have been the seabed minerals that led the United States to walk away from that particular convention. But I know that it's since become customary law, more or less, right? And so we obey it, except when it runs against our national interests, so to speak.
It's very peculiar because there are these tracks that have been identified by the ISA, and then there are tracks that are virtually identical that the United States has identified under its own federal laws. And obviously, a company is not going to invest a lot of resources in mining an area if they believe that there's going to be a claim on it from another powerful entity. To my mind, it's good that we haven't done any mining in the deep sea. But I think one of the reasons that we haven't done any mining, at least under our own federal laws, is because companies are too worried that the ISA is going to say, "Hey, you can't mine there. We already gave that spot to someone else."
In terms of the contracts that are being signed with countries, are these for mining in their exclusive economic zones, which are the 200-mile zones out to sea, or is it deep sea? Or is it the terras nullius, which belongs to no one, which is international? Or high seas.
Any deep sea mining that has happened, and there has been some in Africa and in other parts of the world. It's all within a country's exclusive economic zone, usually much 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 closer, like within 3 miles of shore.
So it's within the coastal mm-hmm. waters, right?
Right.
And that's what
like in
this.
South Africa. Mm-hmm.
Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that in South Africa, potentially Namibia, they've been mining the ocean floor for diamonds.
Right.
And then there's also, I think, phosphate mining that occurs in the ocean. I think that they've done that in Mexico and many other countries. Right. So it's not something that's totally unheard of. But the deep sea mining in the international waters, that's something that no one has touched yet.
But that was my question, right, is that do companies have to sign contracts with countries in order to go out and mine on the deep seabed floor that's within no one's EEZ? Or could they just decide to go out there and, file a claim and start digging?
Well, I think that's what the International Seabed wants, is that, they say that you can't go out there. If you are a corporation that's incorporated in a country that's party to the law of the sea, then you are mandated to go through the ISA mm-hmm. rulemaking process and, the application for the exploration permit or what have you. For countries that aren't party to the law of the sea, it's a different question.
So Lockheed Martin would apply to the U.S. government then for a license? Is that how that would work?
If the U.S. government was a party to the law of the sea and part of the ISA, Lockheed has also like a British subsidiary of Lockheed. You know, all these big countries, not these countries, all these big companies have subsidiaries in different, you know, incorporated in different countries. Mm-hmm. So I think that they can kind of skirt those rules. But for an American country that doesn't have an office or, you know, something else in another country, then it wouldn't be able to apply for a license by the ISA.
Well, when we come back, maybe we can talk about the federal legislation, because I didn't actually know that it exists. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org, streaming on the internet. Today, at 6 o'clock after Sustainability Now, tune in to State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. Most American adults have experienced some kind of traumatic event. Research shows that trauma survivors have a high incidence of physical and mental illness. The good news is that the human nervous system has the capacity to recover. Guest Abby Asher tells how she learned to attend to her own mental health and nervous system while caring for her husband through his 4 years of terminal brain cancer. And psychotherapist and trauma specialist Karen Aus shares her understanding of nervous system physiology and trauma recovery. So join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind today at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and ksqd.org. Right after Sustainability Now. And you are listening to Sustainability Now. Our guest today is Emily Jeffers, a staff lawyer for the Center for Biological Diversity. And we're talking about seabed mineral nodules and the law around mining them. And I was just asking about U.S. federal legislation about the seabed mining. So can you tell us something about that, Emily?
Sure. It's a mouthful. It's called the Deep Seabed Hard Mineral Resources Act. And it was it's a domestic legal regime for deep seabed mining. And it was passed pending adoption of what the Senate considered to be an acceptable international regime, which is, you know, the International Seabed Authority and the United Nations Convention on the Laws of the Sea. And because that has not passed the U.S. Senate, Congress created this alternate process by which companies could apply for a license to explore and extract from the deep sea. So far there have only been several companies who have applied and been granted exploration licensees under this regime, mm-hmm. and none of them have moved to the at-sea exploration phase. It's all been just sort of studies and things of that nature.
So it's kind of like buying leases on oil lands and mineral lands and then just holding them, right, so no one else can
exactly.
get at them.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And every, you know, 10 or 5 years, I can't remember what the statute provides, they just re-up and apply for an extension of their exploration license without doing anything about it.
Presumably, if the ISA started to go into action, then these, you know, the companies and the legislation would also sort of get revivified, I suppose, is the right word, right?
I don't know what will happen once the ISA, once these, you know, the final regulations are enacted and seabed mining proceeds under the ISA. I don't know what will happen with our domestic regime.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's difficult to find reliable data on what all of this is going to cost. And some of the analysts I looked at suggested there are significant profits to be made, while others are more skeptical, you know, especially if you include the environmental impacts. Do you know anything about what the economics might look like?
I don't know what the economics look like, but I do know that if you took into account all the externalities that will occur as a result of mining the deep ocean, I can't imagine a situation in which it plays out and it's worth it. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that's my view, and my view is that there are so many electronics that have been discarded and are in landfills and things of that nature. I don't understand why these mining companies can't mine our landfills for the minerals and the resources they need to make more electronics and other devices. So I think that we should be placing a bigger emphasis on reusing all the minerals that we already have extracted.
Of course, that's not a cheap process, and these corporations don't do that. But I mean, we remember that for a while. I don't know if it's still the case. Old electronics were being sent to Asia, where they were, you know, where the minerals were extracted over small fires that basically, you know, release toxic fumes into the systems of the people who were doing it. I do recall. Well, in the 70s, you know, along with the big increase in oil prices, there was a sort of accompanying increase in various mineral prices, and so the nodules were seen as some kind of savior, right? That if you could increase the supply of these minerals, it would keep the cost down. And somewhere many years ago, I read that Alnico, which was Canadian nickel company, as I recall, basically opposed mining because they were afraid it would bring down the price of nickel. You know, so on the one hand, people want cheap minerals, and on the other hand, corporations want expensive ones. And of course, the economics are quite uncertain, especially on large scale.
There's another angle I saw as well, that the actual expected demand might be overstated, because they're learning ways to create batteries not needing as much cobalt and nickel as they need in a battery today.
That's wonderful.
So it's just interesting that it could be another thing that plays out on whether this actually, you know, pans out economically or not.
Yeah,
and I don't want to sound like I'm lecturing, which it probably sounds like, but a substitution is, of course, another option, and when the cost of the minerals goes way up, there are more incentives to look for substitutes. And so one of the things this kind of mining would do would be to reduce the incentives for looking for substitutes. Brooke, do you have something you'd like to ask?
I do, actually.
Go for it.
I was just curious, in lieu of a ban in California being passed, which, you know, we know that that's being proposed as legislation, but how do you see your law work working in this space?
Well, that's a good question, because we struggle, you know, it's hard to find. I'm an attorney, and I file lawsuits, and we try to practice impact litigation, where we'll bring a lawsuit that we think has an impact on the greater good and can set a precedent for others. But because there aren't very many, there's the Deep Seabed Mining Act that I referenced, and we did file a lawsuit on that several years ago, but there's not a lot of litigation to be done. What can be done, I think, is in the advocacy field and pressuring our lawmakers to take a stand and to join Oregon and Washington, which have already banned deep sea mining, to join them to make it clear that the West Coast is off the table. Not that there is really any interest right now in mining the coast of California or Oregon or Washington, but to hopefully set a precedent. And California has historically been a leader in the environmental field. And so hopefully this could, you know, trickle to other states on the East Coast and the Gulf of Mexico and potentially, you know, other countries as well.
But the states are basically restricted to the 3 mile coastal zone, right? In terms of
exactly,
and beyond that, in the 200 mile EEZ, it's federal law trumps, right? So, is there any sign of that being a concern in Congress?
Because there's Lockheed's license, but other than that, I haven't heard of any interest in any deep sea mining in the United States is EEZ. So it's just not something that it's on my radar, and I don't know if anyone else knows differently. But right now, all the focus seems to be in this Clarion-Clipperton Zone, which is sort of halfway between Mexico and Hawaii, out in the Pacific. So yeah, I don't know anything closer to home.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Brooke?
Okay, I have one more question.
Good.
And it's something that came to me because one of the articles I came across, I think it was a CEO from one of the mining companies interested in seabed nodules, described it as a lifeless desert that there was literally or virtually no harm in mining it. And and it just made me think about, you know, any time that humans sort of penetrate into a wilderness area that didn't provide a utilitarian, you know, purpose in the past, that it's with this mindset that, oh, there's nothing there to disturb that's of value. And recently reading about other countries that have started to pass legislation of nature's rights, it just made me wonder if this is kind of that crux of it, is what if there was just a sense of this space has a reason to be, even if we haven't found a utilitarian purpose for humans there yet. Mm-hmm. And I was just curious if you're being a lawyer, if this is some area that you have any, you know, comments on, this concept of nature's rights.
Well, I, with regards to the statement by the mining company that it's just a wasteland down there, I mean, of course they're going to say that because it's in their best interest. But how long has that area been studied, and how difficult is it to get there, and how little do we know of this area? I absolutely think that that nature has a right to exist, and we derive so much good from it that we don't even know, that we can't quantify. And that we might know in the future or we might not. But, yeah, for sure it has a right to exist. I haven't really been following international. I know that something recently happened in Ecuador or maybe in Mexico, too, regarding a big court victory regarding nature's rights. But from my own perspective, I mean, I think these companies, of course, they're going to say it's a wasteland down there. And no one can say, oh, no, look what I found, because no one can go down there. No one has a submersible that can go 3,000 feet below the surface of the ocean to prove them wrong. So the more scientists we can have studying these areas, the better. But it's, we know more about the surface of the moon than we know about the bottom of the ocean.
Hmm. Right. Hmm. Well, I thought the phrase was funny, too, because it's a lifeless desert. I thought, how many deserts are lifeless? They're teeming
right,
with life.
and I mean, you would think it would be in the interest of those corporations to determine whether those, you know, what is down there, as opposed to just making spurious claims without that kind of knowledge.
I
don't know. What sorts of activities have you been engaged in around this issue?
To be honest, only that lawsuit that we settled, gosh, it was probably 7 years ago. I've been following the issue and sort of taking note of what's been going on around the world and on the West Coast with these state legislations. But I haven't, there's just not a lot of federal litigation that I can get involved in because not many companies are interested in applying for licenses under our federal licensing regime. And if they did, I would certainly want to ensure that they are taking into account all the environmental impact statements and analyses that they before they were able to do any on the water exploration.
So what was the motivation then of Assembly Member Rivas to introduce this bill?
You'd have to ask her, but it's just a preemptive effort, an extra precaution. There's currently no seabed mining taking place in California, but a lot of time that's the best time to pass a bill because we don't have industry's hooks in our legislatures already. So it's a good time to preemptively say, hey, we're not going to have this on our coast. So I think it's a great time to do it, honestly.
Who would be the sort of authorizing agency for controlling this?
There would have to be a lot. I think, the State Lands Committee, the California Coastal Commission, if there was ever going to be, some sort of deep seabed mining activity in California waters, both of those agencies would be heavily involved.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's take another break, and then we'll come back for the last part of the show. Okay. Oops.
Got a good feeling in my soul. I've been listening to that K-Squid radio. Yeah, yeah. It's all right.
The Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History has partnered with Motion Pacific Dance to host a queer dance party and variety show. Marvelous Majesty is a chance to check out amazing art, learn about Santa Cruz queer history, enjoy a variety show, and then shake your tail feathers with DJ Father Taj. This masked event is strictly 18 and older with limited capacity, and it's taking place Thursday, March 17th from 7 to 9 p.m., at the Santa Cruz Museum of Art and History at 705 Front Street in downtown Santa Cruz. More information is available at their website, santacruzmah.org. And you're listening to Sustainability Now. I'm Ronnie Lipschitz in the studio with Brooke Wright. And we're speaking with Emily Jeffers, who is a Berkeley-based staff lawyer for the Center for Biological Diversity. And our topic today has been seabed mining and seabed nodules. And we've just been discussing basically the California legislation that was introduced by Luz Rivas. Emily, what was the history? You mentioned that Oregon and Washington have such legislation. Do you know what the history of those two bills might have been? Why were they motivated to do this?
I imagine it was to make a statement. They both passed theirs in the last, I want to say, 3 or 4 years. And in that time frame, there's also been a lot of statements by big corporations saying, you know, we are opposed to this. I know Patagonia came out recently saying, there shouldn't be deep sea bed mining and other companies as well. And so I think that there's just sort of a groundswell of support against the practice.
Well, of course, Patagonia doesn't do any kind of mineral mining, right?
I actually wanted to ask you that, and I forgot about that. But yeah, when I read up on it, of course, you would expect this from Patagonia, but it was also like Google and technology companies saying they will not use minerals that were derived this way in their products. And I was curious what you thought of the, yeah, do you think that that will have an impact when these large tech companies make that statement as well?
I hope so. I mean, I think that if Google and other huge tech companies say something like that, it carries a lot of weight. I really do. I hope that lots of companies say we're not going to use these minerals. Of course, once they're produced, I don't know how well it's going to, you know, people are going to be able to tell where they came from originally.
Right.
But I hope that we can hold them to those statements.
Yeah, I suppose that would call for a custody tracing, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Figuring out, you know, where they're being refined and then how they're entering into the market. That wouldn't be so easy, would it?
Right.
Brooke, do you have any questions?
Yeah, I just thought, you know, we've talked so much about seabed nodules, and I was curious with your work being around biodiversity, this could mm-hmm. be a new pressure on that, but what are some of the biggest pressures on ocean biodiversity right now that you see as, you know, key points for advocacy and law to take a stand on?
Yeah, that's a great question. There are a lot of threats to our ocean environment, as I'm sure you know. Offshore oil and gas is a big one that a lot of people know about, not just the risks of catastrophic oil spills, but vessel strikes and oil and water pollution. There are a whole host of negative impacts from offshore oil and gas. In addition, you know, everyone knows about the plastics crisis and the plastics that are entering our ocean. And when we started to think about plastics and how we could advocate for marine species, it took us a few years, but eventually we realized we just need to advocate for less plastic to be made in general. And so we have to go upstream and we have to fight these big facilities that are being built that are producing plastic from fracked natural gas. And so that's something that we've been focused on for a while now. And we sued the Army Corps for issuing a permit to Formosa for a $9 or $10 billion facility they're hoping to build in Louisiana. The Army Corps eventually withdrew the permit. So we're trying to go upstream and trying to fight plastic at the source. And then other big threats to the ocean. Marine mammals face a lot of floating ropes in the water and risks of entanglement. And so, you know, in the Monterey Bay area, everyone knows about the Dungeness crab and the entanglements that have happened with humpbacks in the area and also blue whales. Hmm. So that's a risk, is, you know, getting the line out of the water to let these whales survive. Because a lot of whales, they get entangled and they get injured, and some of them die and wash up on shore, and we can see that. But some of them die and we never see from them again, and it's hard to get a good count. But also, if you've ever been out on the water in Monterey Bay, you'll notice, if you see the whales, you'll notice just how many have entanglement scars. Huh. It's really shocking. Hmm. I think something like 80 or 90% of all the humpbacks in the bay have had run-ins with rope from pot fisheries. So that's a big thing that we want to get the line out of the water and let these whales swim free.
And how does that work, getting it out of the water? What does that entail?
Well, so there's new technology. It's called ropeless crab pots. Oh. And so right now, you know, the way it works is a crab pot sits on the bottom of the ocean, and there's a rope or two that run up to the top with a buoy to let the fishermen know where their trap is. But there are these new pots that have the rope spooled in the trap itself, and they're controlled by a remote. And so they'll deploy a buoy when the fisherman wants to go and collect their trap. And so then, you know, there's no rope in the water, and then they can still retrieve the crab that they've harvested. So we're pushing for more ropeless, and there's already lots of trials and successful trials of the technology. So
now, are there
ropes out of the water?
Right, right. Are there rare minerals in that technology? Sorry,
bringing it back around. Yeah,
we don't have to.
I don't know.
I would imagine there are, but I think that's probably beside the point.
Right.
Right. Is there, I mean, I recently read something about legislation around microplastics in particular. Do you know anything about that?
California recently, they finalized their microplastics strategy, which is just a strategy document to try and address the problem. But it doesn't have the weight of law or anything. But I think that there's a lot of potential in stormwater and capturing microplastics, because that's how a lot of the plastic ends up in our ocean to begin with.
Yeah.
So I think there's a lot of potential in that. And, you know, just generally consuming less plastic will lead to less microplastics. So that's what we're really hoping for, is people, governments, you know, recognize the harm that plastics cause, and you know, restrict the production of plastics to begin with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What else? What other issues are sort of germane with respect to biological diversity in the oceans?
Well, you know, aside from
what are you working
from,
on?
Like the Dungeness crab fishery, for example, there are other fisheries that are harmful to marine mammals, and also just overfishing. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, the bluefin tuna, it's at like 1% of its historic population size. Mm-hmm. So there are issues like that. And, you know, a lot of the things that we try to get species that merit protection under the Endangered Species Act, we try to get them those protections, because they're broad and they're impactful, and they can really make a difference on the projection of that species recovery. So we try to get species protected under the Act so they can mm-hmm. enjoy all those protections.
Mm-hmm. I suppose that if seabed mining does develop, then it has the potential to interfere with migrating species.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's another another thing to take into consideration. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add to our conversation?
No, I think, you know, this has been really fun, and thanks for having me on to talk about this topic.
Where can our listeners find out more about this, about what you do and the CBD and the like?
Our website is biologicaldiversity.org, and you can find all about our campaigns and our programs and all the things that we're doing to save life on Earth.
Okay. Well, Emily Jeffers, thank you so much for being our guest on Sustainability Now.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay. A specter is haunting Europe, but this time it is not communism. Vladimir Putin has put Russia's nuclear forces on special combat alert, special combat readiness. For some of us, bringing back memories and fears reminiscent of the darkest days of the Cold War. So what would be the consequences of nuclear war? In 2 weeks, our guest will be Dr. Alan Robach, Distinguished Professor in the Environmental Sciences Department at Rutgers University, and Dr. Joshua Koop, a postdoctoral researcher at Louisiana State University. They and their colleagues are modeling the climatic consequences of a nuclear exchange, not just between Russia and the United States, but other nuclear powers, which might have the potential to trigger nuclear winter. That's a notion popularized by Carl Sagan in the 1980s. Some of us are old enough to remember that. So we're going to be talking about nuclear winter. And it seems like, you know, hopefully it's not a timely subject, but possibly it is. So that's going to be our explosive focus on Sunday, March 20th from 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD. 90.7 FM, and ksquid.org, streaming on the internet. As a reminder, shows from the 5 to 6 p.m. Sunday slot are rebroadcast the following Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. If you'd like to listen to previous shows, you can find them at ksquid.org, ksquid.org/sustainabilitynow, and Spotify, Google Podcasts, and Pocket Casts, among other podcast sites. So thanks for listening, and thanks to all the staff and volunteers who make KSQD your community radio station. And so, until next every other Sunday, Sustainability Now.
What's this? It's just black sand. The government treats it like an extension of the land. Sells it off to the highest bidder. They come suck it up with their giant vacuum cleaner, 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 and the government sings. Our green agenda is central to our vision.
Check out the station that has got the tunes. Check out the station that'll make you move. Come on, child, and take a chance. You're gonna feel it, you'll wanna dance with K-Squid. 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 K-Squid is the place to be. Come on and listen to me. Great DJs, a lot of chat. You know you can where it's at. With K-Squid. With K-Squid. With K-Squid. All night long.
Spend your Monday night at the opera on KSQD Santa Cruz. You'll hear the world's greatest singers tell some of the world's most powerful, romantic, funny, and unforgettable stories, all set to the most glorious music ever composed. It's all about drama and being a diva. Monday night at the opera, 7 to 10 p.m. on KSQD Santa Cruz 90.7 FM.
Goodman, host of Democracy Now!, tune into our award-winning morning news program right here during primetime, 8 o'clock weekday mornings, right here on KSQD on KSQD. Our independent news program offers diverse perspectives, unique opinions unheard in the mainstream media, live as the news unfolds. Tune in for Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report, weekday mornings at 8, right here on KSQD Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
And just as a reminder, directly following this is State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. Most American adults have experienced some kind of traumatic event. Research shows that trauma survivors have a high incidence of physical and mental illness. The good news is that the human nervous system has the capacity to recover. Deborah Sloss's guests tonight are Abby Asher, who will tell how she learned to attend to her own mental health and nervous system, and psychotherapist and trauma specialist Karen Aus, who shares her understanding of nervous system physiology and trauma recovery. So join us in just a few seconds for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind this Sunday evening, just now at 6 p.m.
KSQD, Santa Cruz. The views and opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent those of Natural Bridges Media or KSQD's staff, volunteers, or underwriters.
Welcome to State of Mind, Being Human and Living Well, broadcasting on KSQD Santa Cruz on 90.7 FM and live streaming at ksqd.org. I'm the producer and host, Deborah Sloss, licensed marriage and family therapist, and my pronouns are she, her. 70% of adults in the U.S. have experienced some kind of traumatic event at least once in their lives, and these statistics are based on the most narrow definition of a traumatic event. This is where a person experiences their life being threatened in real or perceived circumstances. But most of us know from our